Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schrankelberg and James Kovacevic on the line. Hey, James.
Hey, Fred, how you doing?
Hey, pretty good. We were just chatting offline, and I didn't know you played golf.
Well, I'm not sure if we can call it playing. Maybe pretending to play might be better. I'm not very good anyways. Okay. I've only played a handful of times in my life, but this year I decided to sign up for a league because if I pay up front, then I'll actually go and actually do it. So,
well, how'd you get that past the boss?
I don't know. Actually, you know what? It's her best friend's husband who invited me out. So,
oh, okay. A little bonding time then. They can go shopping. So careful what you wish for there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's good. In your golfing, have you ever asked somebody to take a look at your swing or to assess really how you play? Or have you ever gotten serious enough to look for some feedback?
I've gotten some feedback so far. I'm inconsistent. Sometimes I swing one way, sometimes I swing a different way. I'm not very consistent in my swing. Okay. That's what I've been told.
All right. So I ask that because it's very similar to what we do in a lot of different processes that we have. And whether it's golfing or shopping or driving to work or whatever, some of our processes that we should pay attention to and make improvements. Like your golf swing, apparently. Others are real money for our organization, right? So in the product development world, I've done hundreds of design team and product development process assessments for how do they achieve the reliability performance of their products that they achieve, and what do they need to do to be better at that, to get more efficient at it or to improve the reliability performance or whatever. And it got me thinking, since I knew we were going to talk today, is I wonder if the process of assessing a reliability program around a factory is similar to what I do for a product development assessment. And so I guess the first question is have you done very many program assessments of how a maintenance program or a reliability program for a facility has been done?
So yeah, I've done quite a few of those assessments in many organizations. So one organization in particular, 9 sites located across North America, assessed all of them initially, followed by a follow-up assessment a year later. To understand where they were, the progress made. I've also worked recently with a few other companies that are just starting that journey. Mm-hmm. So one company, food manufacturer, wanted to understand really where are they and compared to some of the other organizations or just in general against industry best practice. Mm-hmm. So I've gone through and done that and pretty much benchmarked them according to where everyone else is. And I'm actually just did a quote review and proposal review today on one. So for another organization, totally different industry, but done quite a few using multiple different frameworks.
Okay. So, I mean, the generic assessment, whether it's for reliability or whether it's for food safety, for example, is basically there's some criteria or rubric and there's some, and many organizations use a maturity matrix. It's they don't know what they're doing at all. They don't know that they don't know up to that they're very reactive. They are getting good at finding problems and going out and fixing them, yet it's all in a reactionary type mode. And other organizations that are a bit more mature are very predictive
Proactive
is the right word, at getting ahead of where they anticipate issues are going to be and then improving the processes to avoid those difficulties. And so they just have a more efficient running program right from the start. They don't have to wait for things to go wrong. you know, if you, in a maintenance world, if you run out of a spare part for a critical piece of equipment, it's kind of late to find that out, that your spare stocking process is not working when your equipment goes down. Right.
So, absolutely. But that's where a lot of people find out that their program isn't working.
That's right. And that's classic reactionary type thing. And so this assessment process is really, in a high level, is stepping back and looking at it as a process. And there's communication paths, there's physical paths, there's information paths, there's reporting, lagging and leading indicators. It's, to a large extent, it's about how us as a group make decisions. What's our culture around prioritizing and making decisions that guide our reliability programs at a very high level? So in the details, though, looking at the stocking programs or prioritization of repair processes, or do they do measurements on equipment, is similar to what I imagine to what I would do in a product development process. Are they measuring reliability performance over time? Are they identifying key risks for new materials or vendors or so on? Are they taking steps to understand failures when they occur? And I see that there may be quite a few overlaps. Is that is everything I'm talking about similar?
Absolutely. It's, you know, there's a lot of connections. So when we look at doing these assessments, and the model I use is the planned excellence model, mm-hmm. We look at six key areas around that asset management program or maintenance reliability program. We look at people. So when you talk about people, we're talking about, do they have the right structures, the roles, responsibilities defined? Do they have the right capability? Are they using change management to bring people along that journey? You know, we're really mm-hmm. looking at the people side of things. You know, then we start looking at some of the plant stuff. And what is the plant stuff? You know, you're talking about making sure they got a CMMS, so they got that work order management system, they got that failure history, so we can mine it and understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. But that's really, really start looking at the risk component of things. What equipment is really potentially a high risk to us? How are we going to mitigate those risks? Do we have the right spare parts? Do we have an investment or CapEx plan 3, 5, even longer, 10 years out? Identify, do we know when stuff we expect to have to repair or retrofit, upgrade, do that sort of thing. Then we get in a little bit deeper and we start going to some of the processes. So do we have processes mapped? Do we understand who should be doing what, when? And I think you mentioned in previously about, I can't remember if it was one of your speaking of reliability episodes or a different one, but you guys were talking about how you went to a site and depending on which individual is working is when the capacitors were good, because they were manually dumping the materials into the vat to mix it.
That's right. And each guy had a different color criteria of what was the appropriate amount of additive to put into it.
Exactly. So we got to map these processes so they're consistent. And if you want to change them, there's a management of change process involved. You know, once we get all that, then we get into the policies and procedures. So what are those high level policies we need for the very important things? What procedures do we need so we do things consistently and repeatably? Then we get into performance. Are we measuring the right performance objectives? Mm-hmm. Are we following up on it? Because why are you measuring stuff if you're not doing anything with it? And are they applicable to where you are in your organization? And then lastly, we get into the proactive portion. And this is where there's a tremendous amount of overlap with what you guys do. And, you know, we're looking at being proactive when we get that. We start the design phase. Are we doing a RAM modeling? Are we doing Monte Carlo simulations? Mm-hmm. Are we building out the systems with reliability block diagrams to understand the true reliability of that equipment, the design reliability of it anyways, and doing all those things. So there's definitely a huge overlap in a lot of this stuff because, you know, in order to manufacture something to a high level of quality, you need procedures, you need work instructions, you need people to understand what they're doing, you need capable people to do these things. So there's a huge amount of overlap, and where I think there is a large overlap, but maybe the connection isn't made in a lot of organizations, is between that maintenance and that quality program. Mm-hmm. And I say that because if you don't maintain your equipment well and you don't have a repeatable procedure to bring it back to zero state or as good as new or validate that it is in the equipment's operating within specification, it doesn't really matter how good your quality program is. If you don't have that equipment under control, you're going to have variation all over the place.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. There's a huge amount of overlap there. Whether I'm doing something with a high volume, non-repairable type, say a handheld device, or I'm creating a specialized piece of equipment that is repairable, driving out the variability is a key part of design. The whole concept of design or a tolerance analysis isn't to say, well, here's the range I can build it within that it'll work. It's these are my optimum targets, and here's a small window of which we should aim to be centered on or at nominal value for it. In a factory, that shows up in the product that we're producing. The variability gets transferred out the door, basically. And so if I'm designing that equipment, I want it to be as consistent as possible, and so that, one, is I can maintain it more efficiently. I can detect failures or trends towards failures much more quickly. If it's rattling and banging and making all kinds of weird noises, then I can lose that sense of when something is different or off or bad, except for when it all of a sudden goes quiet. Then I used to work in a manufacturing facility as a manufacturing engineer, and we were making circuit boards and stuffing components onto circuit boards. And had all these, we called them chip shooters, these pieces of equipment that would place components on circuit boards into the solder paste, hundreds per minute kind of thing. These things were banging away, making all kinds of noise. And when those machines went quiet, we all knew we were not making money and something was wrong. And so we'd all scurry out to the floor and go figure out what was going on. And you got to the point where you could hear one machine go down out of the 20 that are running. You could tell the difference in the volume. The design needs to dovetail with its purpose. And for factory equipment, it's to make consistent output of a product and to make it viable for us to maintain and keep that system up. So I'll pay more for a piece of equipment that has a good uptime. Right, that has a sustainable track record and it's easy and cost effective to maintain. Well, that happens in design, that you get an easy to maintain piece of equipment.
Absolutely. And there's a trade-off to it though. So it costs a little bit more, but what is the long-term life cycle cost of that? And I was actually demonstrating some life cycle costing to a potential client earlier this week. And how do you evaluate the cost for more reliability? So I was walking through the model we use for how do you evaluate what the life cycle cost is, including lost production because it's not as reliable. Mm-hmm. How do you quantify all that? And even though the upfront price of option B, for example, was twice of what A was, over the course of its 10-year life, there was $300,000 or $400,000 difference and savings because of reduced maintenance time, reduced downtime, all mm-hmm. those things added up for that little upfront cost. But a lot of organizations focus on that upfront cost, not what the long-term impact of it is, unfortunately.
Yeah. You know, and that's part of the assessment is what's driving the decisions. If it's the quarterly numbers or making shipments per month, when I go into a factory, if they've got, well, we can't schedule it the last week of the quarter because we're trying to make our numbers. Well, I'm not going to expect a whole lot out of their program because their priority is make the numbers on a very short-term basis. And so they're going to sacrifice the maintenance program. They're going to sacrifice the paying attention to design and their consistency of their processes just to ship another couple hundred units. And I'm like, it really, and they'll even admit that it's short-term thinking, yet they feel trapped. that that's the game they're in. That's the stakeholders are driving them to do this. Yet in every one of those circumstances, when you sit down with those stakeholders and say, what do you really want? They would choose that extra $300,000 over 10 years, of benefit. Is we can go along as we're doing now and have these random failures and end of quarter pushes and all these other heroics that go on with it and burning people out, or we can have an efficient, running, predictable program. And that goes back to that assessment. Is you're looking for, if you only run out and fix things when they fail, it's completely different scenario and types of recommendations we can make than the team that's doing predictive maintenance when and where it's appropriate and deliberately doing way to it fails because they know that that's the most economical way to treat a piece of equipment. It's when they only choose to do repairs when it fails because they don't know better that there's lots of room for improvement.
That's a key difference. Is you can look at two factories where they run stuff to fail. One made the conscious decision to do that. So therefore, that is an acceptable form of running your equipment.
That's right.
You look at the plant next door to that's they run everything to failure, but that wasn't decided upon through a detailed analysis of risk versus cost and so on and so forth. They just defaulted to that. That is not acceptable as a run to failure strategy.
Exactly. Now, let's say you've got those two factories and you're making bids to both of them to do an assessment. And you get the sense that one's in the very reactive mode, one's in a very proactive mode. Which one do you find more enjoyable to work with and to more challenging, I would say, to work with?
So it depends. So if I think of the one that's very reactive, if there's a willingness to work and to make the improvement, then they're fun to work with because you get to solve that problem. There's a lot of training and light bulb moments and things like that that really are really memorable, I guess. Mm-hmm. If they're willing to change, if they have that attitude of change, if I'm there because I was told to be there by their corporate group or whatever the case is, not so much fun to be there.
Yeah. They're a bunch of prisoners at that point and you're not going to get anything done. Yeah, that's true.
Exactly. Now with the proactive group though, what I find is there's a lot of good collaboration and learning that ends up everywhere. So it's not just them learning. I'm learning at the time because they've tried different innovative things to solve this problem or to address this issue. And, it's very fun to work with people who are passionate and want to get things done. And they take the time to do it properly and invest in the decision.
Yeah. And it also, I find that the proactive groups tend to push you you are going to learn a lot with them. And it's trying to stay up with that and be ahead of them to guide them. Because they came to you looking for what's the next step. We plateaued and it's insignificant compared to the reactive group, what they're working on, but they're very passionate about making that next incremental step of improvement. And they're pushing the envelope in some cases of what their equipment and fundamental processes are capable of doing. And so it's like working on a Formula One race car versus a stock car on the other side. It's just, yep. They both can get the job done. They both go around the track. They do it in very different ways. And the level of expertise involved and the game is different in both cases, in those two cases.
Absolutely. It's there's pros and cons to both.
Now, is there a maturity matrix? I think I saw one. I want to say it was either Rick or Sean put out one in a blog post a couple of years ago. It was kind of a reliability maintenance or maintenance maturity matrix.
There is all kinds of different models and maturity matrices and available out there. Every consultancy pretty much has their own.
Well, I got to steal a couple of them and make some under my letterhead.
Yeah, there's so many. Now, if you're looking strictly at a performance standard, then you're looking at the SMRP best practice guidelines, mm-hmm. where it outlines all the different performance measures, how are they measured, what is best in class considered. If you're looking for a benchmarking type to understand from a maturity standpoint, that's the best way to go. Now, if you're looking for not just those performance measures, but do you have processes in place? What processes are missing? Stuff like that. Then you got to go with whether you develop your own internal assessment or model or use one of the different consultancy ones available. Mm-hmm. Then you got to go to that approach. There's not a universal, here's a maintenance reliability assessment model or matrix.
That's right. The software world has the Carnegie Mellon, I forget the name of it, they have a maturity matrix that's become a universal standard for the software world. It sounds like maintenance world doesn't have a universal one. But the impression I get, though, is they're all fairly simple. Now, one last point, though, is we've talked about doing assessments for organizations and using consultancies. I firmly believe organizations can assess themselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So even if I go to do an assessment for an organization, there's always a part at the end of that conversation around sustaining. Mm-hmm. And my thing to them is do your own assessment. Take what you learned today or throughout this week or previous 2 weeks or whatever the case of that assessment was, mm-hmm. and assess yourself in 6 months. Assess yourself again in 6 months from there and constantly recalibrate and change your short-term tasks. You're not changing that long-term goal because we know what that is. Mm-hmm. But address your short-term tasks, objectives to meet that long-term goal. And then after a year or a year and a half or 2 years, if you want a validation of your own internal assessments, then bring us back to work with you to do another assessment to make sure you're still on the same page. Your internal assessment hasn't gone too high or become too hard or too easy, you know, mm-hmm. to keep mm-hmm. that balance.
To keep you moving. Yeah. I had my very first client when I became a consultant was an assessment for their program. And I made a number of different recommendations and so on. And they called me back 5 years later and said, and it was a different set of managers that sat me down and they showed me a chart that was almost identical to the first chart I saw. And it was, they were showing me the improvement in warranty returns, the basically failures of their product coming back from the field over the last couple of years. And so 2 years ago, they made some nice improvement and then it flattened out for the last year. And they were like, so what do we need to do different? We needed an assessment. And the difference in the two plots was two orders of magnitude differences. There's two decimal points difference in rate of return of field returns. They had improved 100%. Just 2 decades worth of improvement in improving their process, and they were still at it. We need to continue this trend of making improvement. What do we need to do different? And I think that's the real heart of the assessment. And to sum it up here is basically, whether you do it yourself as an organization or you bring somebody in from the outside, is what you're looking for is what do we need to do different that will make a difference, that will improve our program, whether it's improving the uptime of our equipment or saving money on the overall program and maintaining our uptime or designing a product that reduces field failures or meets customers' expectations. And so this assessment process is really a reflection time of how's your process working? And yeah, there's a lot of moving parts. And so being organized about how you go about doing that assessment using a maturity matrix or some other rubric certainly makes sense. And there's plenty of them out there. And James, if a little help from you, we'll find a couple of links and add them to the show notes.
We actually did a whole podcast series on one, the Plant Excellence model, where we covered the model and then in one episode, and then we went into each of the six cells. So the people, plant, processes, so on and so forth.
That's in the Rooted in Reliability program, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. We'll certainly have to link to those. Yes.
And within that, we also had PDFs available for each of the cells for download as well. They were linked in the show notes, I believe.
Oh, excellent. Wow. Well, I'm just going to point to your stuff then, James. I'm glad I asked you. So what else is going on? With assessment, do you see any big developments in the horizon on assessments or or the role of assessments or anything like that? This might be a question out of the blue for you, but.
You know what? They're always evolving. They're always getting better. You know, there's a lot of talk around asset management and ISO 55,000. So the IMA 's got a fairly good assessment model. If you're a member, you can get it for free from them to assess against the ISO 55,000 standard.
Oh, good.
So, and there's organizations are looking to get certified against ISO 55,001 now. So there's a lot of interest in that, which is a good thing. It's just trying to get that common body, common assessment methodology kind of sorted out for that right now. And I know there's a lot of very intelligent people working on that portion of things. So I'm not directly involved with that by any means, but I definitely always trying to stay up to date on that particular piece. So.
Okay. Well, hopefully we see some new and, you know, like you said, it's constantly evolving. I think the fundamental concept isn't new though. And so it's, I guess I should wrap up here is basically say, check out our show notes, go over to reliability.fm and you can find the Speaking of Reliability episode. And there's plenty of ways to leave comments and reviews and so on. Love to hear from you, what you think of the show, what topics we could use. And plus, we're going to have some of these links and pointers and handouts and stuff like that available for you. Thanks again, James, for joining me on the Speaking of Reliability show.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.